This is September 14th, 2008. And the title of this Taisho, one possible title would be Believing is Seeing. And I got onto this yesterday when I heard on NPR that the number of people who believe that Obama is a Muslim is actually rising. And I was flabbergasted, to even more so, to hear that it's increasing than I was hearing months ago that such a phenomenon existed. And so what we believe to a large extent determines what we see and hear and think. And that reminded me of an article I read this summer in The New Yorker called The Itch. And this is for June 30th issue of The New Yorker this year. And I'm going to read from it because it is a very, very dramatic case of this believing is, in this case, feeling. So the title is The Itch, and the subtitle is Its Mysterious Power May Be a Clue to a New Theory About Brains and Bodies. And this is by Atul Gawande, who writes, has written many medical columns for The New Yorker. I'll only read a small portion of this long article, but it's a fascinating and really pathetic case of a woman who, after a bad bout of different medical problems, including shingles, she got the itch. The area of the scalp that was involved became numb, and the pain, this was where the shingles had been, the pain was replaced by a constant, relentless itch. She felt it mainly on the right side of her head. It crawled along her scalp, and no matter how much she scratched, it would not go away. I felt like my inner self, like my brain itself, was itching, she says, and it took over her life just as she was starting to get it back. Her internist didn't know what to make of it. She prescribed a medicated cream, but it didn't help. The urge to scratch was unceasing and irresistible. I would try to control it during the day when I was aware of the itch, but it was really hard, M said. At night, it was the worst. I guess I would scratch when I was asleep, because in the morning there would be blood on my pillowcase. She began to lose her hair over the itchy area. She returned to her internist again and again. I just kept haunting her and calling her, M said. But nothing the internist tried worked, and she began to suspect that the itch had nothing to do with M's skin. And then the author goes off into describing all the many possible causes of a persistent itch, including psychiatric and as a symptom of obsessive-compulsive disorder. She quotes Montaigne, who I can't remember who that is, but some big name from history, who said, scratching is one of the sweetest gratifications of nature and as ready at hand as any. But repentance follows too annoyingly close at its heels. And then the author says, for M, certainly it did. The itching was so torturous and the area so numb that her scratching began to go through the skin. One morning, after she was awakened by her bedside alarm, she sat up and, she recalled, this fluid came down my face, this greenish liquid. She pressed a square of gauze to her head and went to see her doctor again. M showed the doctor the fluid on the dressing. The doctor looked closely at the wound. She shined a light on it and in M's eyes. Then she walked out of the room and called an ambulance. Only in the emergency department at Massachusetts General Hospital, after the doctors started swarming and one told her she needed surgery now, did M learn what had happened. She had scratched through her skull during the night and all the way into her brain. And then skipping a number of paragraphs here, it goes into a history of dermatology and all. But to pick up now, in the operating room, a neurosurgeon washed out and debrided M's wound, which had become infected. Later, a plastic surgeon covered it with a graft of skin from her thigh. Though her head was wrapped in layers of gauze and she did all she could to resist the still furious itchiness, she awoke one morning to find that she had rubbed the graft away. The doctors returned her to the operating room for a second skin graft, and this time they wrapped her hands as well. She rubbed it away again anyway. She says that they kept telling her she had obsessive-compulsive disorder. Psychiatric team was sent in to see her each day. The resident would ask her each day, as a child, when you walked down the street, did you count the lines? Did you do anything repetitive? Did you have to count everything you saw? She kept saying no and no, no, and they kept suspecting that it was a symptom of OCD. A new doctor injected her with a few drops of local anesthetic, and the itchiness stopped instantly and almost entirely, but the itch came back when the anesthetic wore off. They tried an anesthetic patch. That didn't last long. They took a biopsy of the itchy skin. It showed that 96% of the nerve fibers were gone. Now we're getting into the realm of Buddhism. And believing is feeling. The physician came up with two theories. One related to the nerve fibers, and the other was that the itch system in M's brain had gone haywire, running on a loop all its own. They thought the first theory, meaning the sensory perception itself from the sensory endings in the nerves, was the more likely one, and they ended up cutting the nerve. Physician suggested that the woman not let them do the cutting, but she said she was desperate. And by this time, it had gotten so bad that the only way to keep her from tearing her skin and skull open again was to put a foam football helmet on her head and bind her wrists to the bed rails at night. She spent the next 2 years in a locked medical ward. And although she was not mentally ill, she was considered a danger to herself. So they dressed her up, the staff were dressed her up every night in these mitts and bindings, and finally after 7 years, she was discharged from the hospital, and she says, although the itch on her scalp and forehead persists, she has gradually learned to protect herself. She trims her nails short. She finds ways to distract herself. And it says, some of her doctors have not been willing to let go of the idea that this has been a nerve problem all along. A local neurosurgeon told her that the original operation to cut the sensory nerve to her scalp must not have gone deep enough. "He wants to go in again," she told me. Well, we actually don't hear any more about this woman, but we hear about other such cases where feelings just can't be explained. And the most clear case of that is the phenomenon of phantom limbs, feeling pain or itching or whatever in phantom limbs. That is, legs or arms that have been amputated. I bet most people here have heard of that phenomenon. Now, just turning away from the medical here for a minute. He writes, "A new scientific understanding of perception has emerged in the past few decades, and it has overturned classical, centuries-long beliefs about how our brains work, though it has apparently not penetrated the medical world yet. The old understanding of perception is what neuroscientists call the naive view, and it is the view that most people, in or out of medicine, still have. We're inclined to think that people normally perceive things in the world directly. We believe that the hardness of a rock, the coldness of an ice cube, the itchiness of a sweater are picked up by our nerve endings, transmitted through the spinal cord like a message through a wire, and decoded by the brain." And then it refers to George, the Irish philosopher George Berkeley, objecting to this view as long ago as 1710, where he said, "We do not know the world of objects. We know only our mental ideas of objects." Now we're right smack into the Buddhist experience. And the affirming faith in mind, those lines, "Things are things because of mind." He said, "Light and colors, heat and cold, extension and figures, in a word, the things we see and feel, what are they but so many sensations, notions, ideas? Indeed," he concluded, "the objects of the world are likely just inventions of the mind put in there by God." Well, not so Buddhist there. To which Samuel Johnson famously responded by kicking a large stone and declaring, "I refute it thus." Now, this is in Buddhism, we would never say that everything is just a subjective. This is subjective idealism. What in philosophy is known as subjective idealism, that everything is just concocted by our own mind, but rather it's a co-arising of these, that things are things because of mind. That's what Berkeley said. As mind is mind because of things, it is a false distinction to separate things and mind. These are just words that we constructed. We just slap these words onto reality. We split it down the middle, and we said there's the world of things out there, and then there's our own mind. But the experience, the direct experience, refutes that. So Samuel Johnson was just taking the other side. But either side, pure objectivity or pure subjectivity, is only half the truth. Berkeley had recognized some serious flaws in the direct perception theory, in the notion that when we see, hear, or feel, we are just taking in the sights, sounds, and textures of the world. For one thing, it cannot explain how we experience things that seem physically real but aren't. Sensations of itching that arise from nothing more than itchy thoughts, dreams that can seem indistinguishable from reality, phantom sensations that amputees have in their missing limbs. And the more we examine the actual nerve transmissions we receive from the world outside, the more inadequate they seem. Our assumption had been that the sensory data we receive from our eyes, ears, nose, fingers, and so on contain all the information that we need for perception, and that perception must work, and that perception must work something like a radio. It's hard to conceive that a Boston Symphony Orchestra concert is in a radio wave, but it is. In Buddhism, we talk about a sixth sense, the six senses, the five that we ordinarily think of as the physical senses, and the sense, the sixth sense of thought or thinking. So our thoughts are also conditioned by the mind, just as our perceptions, the feelings and sights and so forth. So we're moving now into what is often called the brain's best guess theory of perception, the brain's best guess. The mind fills in most of the picture in what we think of as direct perception of things as they are. It all, of course, has to go through the mind, and the mind interprets reality. You can get a sense of this from brain anatomy studies. If visual sensations were primarily received rather than constructed by the brain, you'd expect that most of the fibers going to the brain's primary visual cortex would come from the retina in the eye. Instead, scientists have found that only 20% do. 80% come downward from regions of the brain governing functions like memory. Richard Gregory, a prominent British neuropsychologist, estimates that visual perception is more than 90% memory. Visual perception is more than 90% memory and less than 10% sensory nerve signals. So the author writes, when the physician theorized that M's itch was endogenous rather than generated by peripheral nerve signals, she was onto something important. And then he goes on, the fallacy of reducing perception to reception is especially clear when it comes to phantom limbs. Doctors have often explained such sensations as a matter of inflamed or frayed nerve endings in the stump, sending aberrant signals to the brain. But efforts by surgeons to cut back on the nerve typically produce the same results that M had when they cut the sensory nerve to her forehead, a brief period of relief followed by a return of the sensation. So the brain's best guess theory of perception is that perception is the brain's best guess about what is happening in the outside world. The mind integrates scattered, weak, rudimentary signals from a variety of sensory channels, information from past experiences, and hardwired processes, and produces a sensory experience full of brain-provided color, sound, texture, and meaning. And this certainly matches the Buddhist and the Zen understanding of how we experience reality. And it gets us into karma, that our whole past, the whole sum total of past experiences to a large extent determines how we are perceiving things and people. There are a couple of terms here that I heard a lot of when I was at this the Mind and Life Summer Research Institute in June, this conference of neuroscientists. And these are the terms top-down and bottom-up. Very loosely, roughly speaking, top-down means those the aspect of experience that is determined by our brain and our memory. Bottom-up refers to the sensory sensory driven experience, you know, the actual feeling. I think the ultimate in top-down functioning we see in hypnosis. I don't know if a neurologist would agree with this. It just came to me this morning that in hypnosis you can convince people in their hypnotic trance that they're experiencing the opposite of what they're experiencing, that they can put their hypnosis subject can have her hand in some ice water and believe that it's hot through this hypnotic suggestion. So that's top down, completely. And we know that these things are valid, that they can experience things that way. I think that's the most extreme example of top down. But it is a very sobering thing to understand that there's no world out there separate from us that we can experience as if we're just pure instruments, that whatever we're experiencing is a function of our past experiences, our memory. Remember, 90% memory. Visual perception is more than 90% memory and less than 10% sensory nerve signals. But it's not just a matter of our sense experiences. It's also, in the ordinary sense of senses, but it's also the way we perceive people in our interactions with them. That the way we understand people and their intentions and what they're saying and the way they're responding is so much a function, is so much determined by this whole vast, beginningless mass of karma that we have. Buddhist teaching has it that moment by moment, millisecond by millisecond, what we are doing and saying and thinking is being sown as seeds of future karma, so that the next moment, what we're experiencing is very much affected by not just the last a minute ago, those seed experiences, but the whole mass of them from beginningless time. So it really is a responsibility of anyone who really is committed to experiencing reality as it is to question what the basis is of our perceptions. So back to this stubborn belief that an alarming number of people have that Obama is Muslim. Well, first, let me say, I don't know for sure that he's not, but what I always wonder is how many of those people who stubbornly believe he's a Muslim, contrary to any evidence, how many of those people were dismayed at his involvement in a church for 25 years, a Christian church for 25 years, with this Jeremiah, whatever, who was making all these inflammatory things. how do they reconcile that? I think the we can safely assume that Obama is not Muslim. And yet, people believe that. There are people who believe that. So they have no direct evidence of it. But there it is. It's somehow they have... they are predisposed by their belief system to ignore all the evidence of his lifetime of Christian involvement, to ignore that and cling to the belief that he's Muslim. This is just one example. You know, both sides does this. This is how we function as human beings. Democrats or liberals come with our own set of preconceptions that we lay over the world. So perception, not just seeing, hearing, feeling, tasting, and smelling, but the sixth sense, thinking, perception of all kinds is really a construct. We construct it. And other books that I've read in the last few years also confirm this, present evidence, research that confirms this. Moment by moment, we're constructing our world. We're constructing our experience. But it's only a rough and incomplete snapshot of the world. I'm going to go back to the article and read some fascinating research that they've done with people who have this phantom limb sensations. He says, you've likely had an experience of phantom sensation yourself. When the dentist gives you a local anesthetic and your lip goes numb, the nerves go dead. Yet you don't feel your lip disappear. Quite the opposite. It feels larger and plumper than normal, even though you can see in a mirror that the size hasn't changed. And then an experiment that an Indian physician did, performed with volunteers who had phantom pain in an amputated arm. They put their surviving arm through a hole in the side of a box with a mirror inside, so that peering through the open top, they would see their arm and its mirror image, as if they had two arms. Ramachandran then asked them to move their intact arm, their one intact arm, and in their mind, their phantom arm, to pretend that they were conducting an orchestra, say. The patients had the sense that they had two arms again. Even though they knew it was an illusion, it provided immediate relief. People who for years had been unable to unclench their phantom fist suddenly felt their hand open. Phantom arms in painfully contorted positions could relax. With daily use of the mirror box over weeks, patients sensed their phantom limbs actually shrink into their stumps and, in several instances, completely vanish. Researchers at Walter Reed Army Medical Center recently published the results of a same kind of mirror therapy for soldiers with phantom limb pain and showed dramatic success. A lot about this phenomenon remains murky, but here's what the new theory suggests is going on. When your arm is amputated, nerve transmissions are shut off, and the brain's best guess often seems to be that the arm is still there, but paralyzed, or clenched, or beginning to cramp up. Things can stay like this for years. The mirror box, however, provides the brain with new visual input. See, there's the bottom-up part of it. We can't deny either side, the objective or the subjective. So the mirror box provides the brain with new visual input, however illusory, suggesting motion in the absent arm. The brain has to incorporate the new information into its sensory map of what's happening. Therefore, it guesses again, and the pain goes away. The new theory may also explain what was going on with M's itch. The shingles destroyed most of the nerves in her scalp, and for whatever reason, her brain surmised from what little input it had that something horribly itchy was going on, that perhaps a whole army of ants were crawling back and forth over just that patch of skin. But M's brain has received no contrary signals that would shift its assumptions. So she itches. Thus, supporting the evidence, the increasing evidence, that our sensory experiences are not sent to the brain, but originate in it. Now, this understanding of experience is certainly supported by my own experience working with people in Sesshin, people who are going through pain while sitting, pain in their legs, their back, or whatever. That many, many years ago, I'd already come to the conclusion, hearing from so many people, and through my own experience, of course, that pain, physical pain, is very largely determined by the mind. Anyone who has had the experience of seeing pain vanish during Sesshin, or outside Sesshin, it's just that Sesshin is more common, this kind of a sudden flip of experience, knows how much pain is determined by the mind. Not entirely. If you put your hand over a flame, you don't say that's just the mind. But it is so much determined by the mind and our experience, what we're expecting. There's another New Yorker article, or maybe it was another magazine, years ago, I don't know what happened to it, about pain and how the increasing research that shows that pain is very much determined by whether we're expecting pain. There it is again. That's the top down. The brain expecting something, and then pain coming from that, the experience of pain. In the end, the whole thing about experience, the objective-subjective duality just breaks down. How can you ever separate things from mind? How can experience be anything but the fusion of the objective and the subjective, mind and objects? I also was reminded of the fact that Zen is generally considered part of the Yogacharya school of Mahayana Buddhism. Mahayana Buddhism scholars will often distinguish between those schools that are part of the what are called the Majjhimika tradition and those that are part of the Yogacharya tradition. Let's just focus on the Yogacharya. Yogacharya means, the central notion of the Yogacharya is that everything experienceable is mind only. Things exist only as processes of knowing, not as objects, in quotation marks. Outside the knowing process, they have no reality. The so-called external world is thus purely mind. Just as there are no things apart from object. No. Just as there are no things qua objects, there is also no subject who experiences. Perception is a... I'm reading here from the Encyclopedia of Buddhist Philosophy, of Asian Philosophy and Religion. Perception is a process of creative imagination that produces apparently outer objects. Let's plug in there the case of this poor M. Perception is a process of creative imagination that produces apparently itching. This process is explained with the help of the concept of the storehouse consciousness. That's the Alaya Vijnana. Storehouse consciousness is what I just alluded to, though not by that name, where all of our actions and speech and words are filed away in this deep storehouse, this great vault that then, to a large extent, determines future reactions to the world. It goes on, the mechanism of the arising of the external world is explained in the Yogacharya in the following manner. In the Alaya Vijnana, that's the storehouse consciousness, which is the ground of knowledge and the storehouse of all previous impressions, seeds develop, which produce mental phenomena. As the storehouse of all seeds, the Alaya Vijnana is the determining factor for the process of ripening by which the Yogacharya explains the development of karma. In the storehouse consciousness, the seeds affect each other in such a way that their interaction creates the deception that something really exists. The Alaya Vijnana is often compared to a stream, the water of which perpetually renews itself, and after the death of an individual being, continues to flow, it providing continuity from one existence to the next. So after the death of the sensory nerve that they cut in M, it still provides continuity from one existence to the next. Again, even though Yogacharya can be literally translated as mind only, it's not subjective mind as opposed to objective perception, but rather things exist only as processes of knowing. That is, the co-arising of the fire and the stove and your own mind. That's where the perception of heat comes from. The implications of this are, it cannot be overstated. It means that in our experience, never mind sensations of feeling and smelling and tasting and so forth, but our interpretation of people, in our interacting with people, the way we see people and their intentions and all, is so much determined by our past experiences. The difficulties we have in relationships are so much determined by our past experiences in this lifetime and even long before this lifetime. The whole cumulative experience, our cumulative karma. Well, this all one can spin off and get into thinking about all this, but that's not the point. It's how then, in practical terms, what are the implications of this? How do we deal with the world. I would say the key thing, just in terms of our interactions with people, is we really listen to what they're saying. We really listen without preconceptions, without our mind buzzing with what we think we know about that person and what their agenda is and everything else, but simply hearing him or her as they're speaking. Well, this is easier said than done. That's where the Zazen comes in. Zazen, the more sitting we do, the easier it is to just listen, and the more likely that we will hear things as they are, not through this clogged filter of our own karma, but as they are. Hear things as they are, see people as they are. It all comes back to the sitting. Sitting and in our daily life, refraining from building up thoughts, grasping at thoughts and concepts, staying as free of these things as possible so that we can take things in directly and not completely misinterpreting things and people. That's what Yogacharya, another way to understand it, is it's the school that emphasizes yoga. Yoga in the wide sense, yoga meaning physical discipline, meditation. Not hatha yoga, but that emphasizes meditation as the way to clean the, blow out the air filter in our minds that is causing so many problems and misperception. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.